Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments. Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, May 22nd. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Shartok. Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology, celebrating June as National Cancer Survivor Month, with special events planned at all 7 offices for all NYOH patients and survivors. NewYorkOncology.com. Joining us this afternoon on Medical Monday is Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center. He specializes in pediatric neurology and neonatal stroke. Now, we always get a lot of calls on Medical Monday, so get your call in early. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Malik, your calls and much more coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff, in for Alan Shartok today. Joining us on this Medical Monday is Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center. Dr. Malik specializes in pediatric neurology and neonatal stroke. He is board certified in psychiatry and neurology. He earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College. Our number here on Medical Monday, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You may also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email address. But again, the number on this call-in program is 800-348-2551. Dr. Malik, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray. It's great to be here.
And happy birthday, man.
Thank you, sir.
I can't believe you're spending it with us.
Oh, it's the best birthday present ever.
Really? we'll find out about that. So what made you want to focus on pediatric neurology?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I went to Albany Medical College, and actually neurology was my worst subject there. I wanted to go into pediatrics. I love pediatrics, loved hematology, oncology. Working with kids with cancer was really a passion of mine. And I actually worked at the Double H Ranch up in Lake Luzerne.
Sure.
And so I was really, you know, set on hematology, oncology. I did my residency back at Tufts Medical Center in Boston, mm-hmm. Where I'm from. It wasn't really until the end of residency that I started to fall in love with neurology. It's just the complicated puzzle of the human brain, just trying to tease that out, studying it, observing it, it's addictive.
What special challenges are there in pediatric neurology?
I guess the biggest thing is that sometimes the patients don't tell you what's wrong with them. Mm. But it can be a blessing and a curse, you know. I have had the fortune of having really observant parents, and parents really are kind of like a nurse, basically watching the kid, and they can report to me, he's not right, he's right, he's gotten better, and that's really something I depend pretty heavily on when I'm trying to make my diagnoses. But the problem is I can't, in a lot of cases, I cannot ask the kid directly what's bothering them or when it started.
It's tough for parents, though. Being a parent myself, you can be overly sensitive to any little changes. So you may get false alarms in your line of work.
Oh, that's by 90% of the time.
90%? Well, that's good. That's good news. Our number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center, and he is an expert in pediatric neurology and neonatal stroke. How common is neonatal stroke?
Fairly common. If you look at the incidence of stroke throughout a person's life, really obviously the most strokes happen in older age and people with stroke risk factors, things like diabetes, heart disease, mm-hmm. Things of that nature, cigarette smoking. But early on in life, in the first, let's say, 24, 48 hours, both before birth and after birth, moms sometimes have a tendency to form blood clots. Mm. And the reason is probably the reason why they form blood clots is because, you know, they're expected to hemorrhage quite a bit during the delivery.
Right.
So they need to be able to sort of stop that bleeding. But sometimes that system doesn't work quite appropriately. And sometimes the moms can form a blood clot in the placenta. That blood clot can head up the umbilical artery and cause a stroke to the baby. So we do see a good number of strokes, and most of the time we never figure out exactly why.
So you can't figure out exactly why, but are there warning signs, are there red flags before birth that you can say, okay, well, we have to watch this one?
usually the mom's risk factors kind of determine the baby's risk factors for a stroke. So moms who smoke cigarettes sometimes are at an increased chance of having a stroke, who have diabetes, especially uncontrolled diabetes, and also moms with heart disease or inherited genetic risk factors for blood clots. Those are the babies that we pay attention to. But usually it just happens out of the blue, and there's really nothing the mom can do to prevent or anticipate that.
And you work extensively, I'm told, with autism.
Yes, sir. Well, any type of neurodevelopmental disorder, autism, fine motor delay, gross motor delay. Actually, in our clinic, we don't specifically see for autism. That usually goes to somebody called a developmental pediatrician. But autism, for me, is something that I see quite commonly because it goes along with a lot of other neurologic disorders in kids. And I approach autism a little bit differently than the pediatricians or the developmentalists. For me, autism is a symptom, kind of a piece of the puzzle as to what a kid is. It doesn't really define the kid for me. But I look at autism as sort of a clue when I'm trying to solve a case.
Dr. Sohail Malik is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Laurel in Rosendale. Laurel, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hi.
So my question has to do with, hi, doctor, has to do with the relationship with blood sugar and our increase in diabetes, especially type 2 diabetes in the pediatric population. And Alzheimer's has recently been sort of discussed as possibly type 3 diabetes. And I'd like to know your take on the role of the increase in type 2 diabetes in our kids and what type of relationship you might be seeing along those lines.
Okay, Laura, we're going to turn you down here, but we'll bring you back for a follow-up.
Thank you so much for calling, Laurel. It's an excellent question. So obviously, nutrition overall is a major concern for us pediatric neurologists. I would say with type 2 diabetes specifically, I don't see any issues in kids. The long-term sequelae from type 2 diabetes don't really show up in kids. But if you think about sugar, as too much sugar is kind of a toxin in the body. Too little sugar can be a toxin. Too much sugar can be a toxin. What that toxin does is it affects the blood vessels, and it can cause those blood vessels to have damage from a complicated mechanism. And that damage can happen anywhere in the body. And obviously, the brain is an area that we are very concerned about for neurodegenerative disorders like Alzheimer's. Also, we're looking at other types of pediatric disorders, things like ADHD, learning disability, but a direct correlation between type 2 diabetes and pediatric neurologic disorders hasn't totally been established. However, I do want my kids to have proper nutrition and to control their blood sugar so that, you know, obviously they can have good, healthy adulthoods.
Okay, Laurel?
Yes.
Thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Our number is 800-348-2551. Over to Sally in New Windsor, New York. Sally, you're on.
Hi. My youngest child, Elizabeth, had a stroke when she was 6 years old, and that was in October 25th of 1991. And I was just wondering, if it had happened now, would we have been able to diagnose it much earlier? She the reason for the stroke was she had two heart defects, and when I was expecting Lizzie, I had a really difficult pregnancy, and I went into labor at 23 weeks, and we had to, I had to be in Albany Med for a long time to be able to avoid the pregnancy aborting. So I was just wondering, you know, as a mom, if there was anything that if this happened now, if the family wouldn't have to, you know, have it happen to a child later.
Okay.
I'm sorry to hear that, Sally. What year did you say your daughter had the injury?
It was in 91, in October 91. Of 91.
Okay. So a very important question because now we have this the substance that we're using quite a lot in adults called tissue plasminogenase activator, TPA. You might have heard about this in the adult population. That's really the reason why a lot of these public health campaigns are encouraging people to identify stroke quickly and get people to the hospital or call EMS as soon as possible, as soon as the signs and symptoms of stroke are noticed. It's because if the substance is given, it's basically a sort of acute onset blood thinner. It breaks up a clot right away, and it can be given through a vein. So our goal really is to give this substance 3 hours into a stroke. Now, there's a lot of groups, especially out of Children's Hospital Boston, which is looking at using this substance for kids, and it's showing a lot of good results. Okay. This substance can break up that clot within 3 hours, and also there's other procedures that we can do, neurosurgical procedures, where we go in through the artery and take out that clot. So it is very important to look and think about stroke as a possible cause of neurologic injury to kids. Although, you know, after that neonatal period, it's much more rare, but it does happen. And if you are able to get your child to a hospital within 3 hours, before 3 hours or as soon as possible, there is a chance that we can give this TPA, tissue plasminogen activator, and really sort of get rid of that clot earlier, restore proper blood flow to the brain, and prevent a lot of injury. However, it is very difficult to find the signs and symptoms of a stroke in kids. Like I said, they don't tend to complain about stroke. But if you are noticing the same signs and symptoms of stroke in your child as you would expect in an adult, drooping on one side of the face, slurred speech, weakness or numbness, or even visual deficits that happen right away, acute onset, then I would think about stroke and think about getting them to a hospital as soon as possible and ask the emergency room provider if they think their child is having a stroke. That would raise that suspicion for the provider and possibly lead to this this really important intervention.
Sally, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Our number here is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Our guest today is Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center. It is Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from the 1850 House Inn and Tavern, the 1850house.com, 845-658-7800. Spate Consulting and Coaching, Shelburne Falls, more than 20 years of working with leaders and teams committed to purposeful change. See it whole at MoveItForward, DLSPECHT.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Painter Edith Hunsberger exhibiting watercolor and acrylic paintings at Paradise City in Northampton, Massachusetts. Memorial Day weekend, booth number 935, edith-hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the capital region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, actsurg.com. And from Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors, serving the Northeast since 2001. StoneSoupConcrete.com and on Facebook.
Fox Pop, Medical Monday, Ray Graff in for Alan today. Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551, and let's go to our old buddy Jim in Matamoros. Jim.
What are some of the neurological pathways involved in the transmission of symptoms of infectious disease?
Thank you for the question, Jim. So are you thinking about any particular infectious disease in particular?
Rickettsia, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, the uncontrollable itch you get in the palms of your hands and the soles of your feet.
Uh-huh. So you're thinking about things that are sort of transmitted by a tick or a mosquito. So, you know, in general, you know, obviously there's not direct contact from one nervous system to another nervous system or a virus to the nervous system. Our nervous system is pretty well protected. There are some exceptions to that. Herpes simplex virus is one that comes to mind. Herpes simplex virus tends to get pretty quickly from the skin to the peripheral nerve and it get into the nervous system from that pathway. But in general, the nervous system, especially the central nervous system, is pretty well protected from infectious disease. There's something called the blood-brain barrier, which really filters out all the contaminants, all the toxins, and a lot of the viruses and bacteria that would normally affect other tissue. So despite this blood-brain barrier, there are a few pathogens that can get into the central nervous system or get through the peripheral nervous system and kind of use that as kind of like a little highway, or not a highway, a byway, to try to get into the central nervous system. Rickettsia is one great example of that, and you know, obviously the biggest example in this area would be the Lyme disease. Lyme disease is fairly notorious for causing peripheral neuropathies, and those are basically nervous system disorders that affect the nerves as they leave the spinal cord or as they leave the brain, which are not protected by the blood-brain barrier, which is probably how Lyme is able to cause so much neurologic dysfunction.
Jim, we appreciate the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It is Medical Monday, and Jessica in Warwick, Massachusetts. Jessica, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm mom of an 11-year-old who has had multiple concussions, and he now seems to have kind of a migraine syndrome happening. He gets them, I'd say monthly anyway now, but he has had times where he's gotten them more frequently, spends a day in pain, throwing up. And I've had different doctors say different things about whether that's, I don't know that it actually is a syndrome, but that they think that that's what it's from. I guess I wonder what your take is on the relationship with concussions and headaches persisting, and what I should do going forward to make sure that he doesn't have some central lesion or something.
I'm sorry to hear that about your son or daughter, Jessica?
Son.
Son. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. And hopefully he recovers pretty well. I know concussions have been a hot topic basically everywhere throughout the country, and the science is really evolving fairly fast regarding pediatric concussions, and I think it's a really important matter to discuss. Obviously, I'd have a lot of follow-up questions to try to figure out how much of your son's migraine disorder is due to the concussions. However, you know, as a general rule of thumb, this is what happens. You get a head injury, and really the head injury, the mechanism of the head injury matters quite a bit. And we think concussions are tend to be more severe when there's very quick acceleration, deceleration. The head moves, and then it stops moving really fast. So obviously automotive accidents tend to be the most serious concussions, or even traumatic brain injuries. And what happens after that type of injury, we think, is that there's this neurotransmitter called glutamate that basically gets released throughout the brain tissue. And glutamate's kind of the precursor to a lot of other types of neurotransmitters, things like dopamine, serotonin. And that glutamate's basically upregulated in the central nervous system.
Why?
Lots of glutamate going around. It's probably due to the injury. We don't really, not really sure why. There's a chance it could have a protective function as well. Maybe after somebody gets a head injury, you don't want them necessarily to be unconscious, because they have to be aware. They have to be ready for a second head injury. So it could be that glutamate stimulates the brain and gets people out of that situation in which they got the head injury. Think about that from an evolutionary perspective. That's just a theory of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But it could be that it's a little bit protective as well. I'm not really sure. But the problem is, anytime you release a stimulant into the system, like dopamine or epinephrine, adrenaline, that can trigger headaches, because what it does is it sort of taxes the brain, puts the brain under a little bit of stress. So especially in the days to weeks after a mild, moderate, severe concussion, children very commonly have headaches, but also they have, you know, other symptoms as well, namely balance problems and cognitive problems, short-term memory problems. Now, a lot of times I'll see those cognitive problems, I'll see those balance problems get better, but the kids not only having headaches, but sometimes the headaches get worse. And we don't really know exactly what happened. Did the child acquire something like a migraine disorder? I'd say every case is a little bit different. You know, I'd certainly look at sleep. I think sleep's pretty critical towards preventing these types of headaches. Now we're gathering a lot more evidence on pediatric concussions. We find that really the symptoms of concussion last a lot longer than we think. So it could be that your son hasn't fully recovered from that head injury and is maybe pushing it too much in terms of the daily activities.
And how much sleep should he get?
Well, that's very patient-specific. In general, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends about 8 to 10 hours of sleep for every child, but some kids need more, some kids need less, and especially after a head injury, you may notice your child sleeping a lot more. And that may be the child trying to heal from that injury. Mm.
Jessica, thank you. We have to move on here. Our guest today is Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center, and our number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Mokhtar in Albany. You're on.
Hi, doctor. I have a simple question. It's about the neurological issue. So, obviously, myself, I have a neurological issue, and I'm 43, and I'm kind of having the balance issue, and obviously, Dr. Malik is, I'm listening to him, he's kind of describing my, he's kind of diagnosing myself. Then I would like to ask if the neurological issue may be something genetic.
So nerve issues being genetic. Okay.
I'm sorry to hear about your neurologic illness, but, I'm glad you asked about genetics. I mean, genetics is really, ever since the Human Genome Project, really we've learned so much about the genome itself. So neurologic issues can be really from anything. They can be acquired from things like head injuries, from strokes, from blood vascular problems. They can be caused by infectious problems, inflammatory problems from the immune system. But they can also be due to genetic issues quite commonly, especially in children. These issues tend to be genetic, programming errors that happen throughout the cells of the body. You know, we used to think that all the cells in the body had the same genetic programming. Mm. They had the same DNA. Now, it turns out that's not quite true. Oh. Every cell in the body has little tiny mutations here and there. In fact, you can think about the cells of the body as snowflakes. No two cells are the same. Throughout development, and including neurologic development and throughout your life, your cells of your body may pick up little tiny mutations that might lead to neurologic disease. Now, you may be predisposed to that by inheriting that from your mother or father, or that just might be an accident. It might be a genetic problem that happened all of a sudden. Mm. So genetics is quite complicated, and we're learning more and more about the genetics of the human body. However, we still have to learn a lot more about how those genes get translated into actual function in the body.
All right, Mokhtar, thank you for that call. Our number here on Medical Monday is 800-348-2551. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok today, joined by Dr. Sohail Malik. And let's go over to Gazana from Bassett Medical Hospital. You're on.
Yeah. Dr. Sohail, this is Dr. Nathu. I appreciate all of the knowledge you are passing all of to us, we all groups sitting and listening, and thank you for the program is choosing Dr. Malik to, making more clear talk on the stroke. Is the age is any contraindication for the TPA?
Thanks for calling.
Well, explain, first of all, what that doctor just said for the rest of us.
TPA? I had mentioned the tissue plasminogenase activator, the substance that's given to adults in an acute stroke to help break up that blood clot.
Okay.
And what Dr. Nathu is asking about, and Dr. Nathu is actually my aunt.
Oh, really?
Well, my wife's aunt, but still
nice.
My aunt. She's a wonderful doctor.
That's great.
And thank you for the question. but it's an excellent question because what's the age cutoff?
Okay.
How young can these babies get it? And unfortunately, it has not been studied in the neonatal period. And I believe, although the Children's Hospital Group is, the stroke consortium is looking at using tissue plasminogenase activator in kids as young as two, I'm not completely sure whether they've studied younger than two. So right now, the very sort of tenuous recommendation is that kids older than two can receive tissue plasminogenase activator. But to be honest with you, I'm not sure if kids younger than two can receive that that TPA, but I can certainly look that up. And
what would the fear be of giving that too young to a too young patient?
The biggest concern would be bleeding. Are you going to cause bleeding in these patients? And it can be complicated. You have to figure out what's going on, what caused the stroke. And younger than two, it's very difficult to tell when they're going to when they have the symptoms of a stroke, because most kids younger than two that have a stroke actually present with a seizure when they're younger than two. Mm-hmm. They don't present with the classic signs or symptoms. So usually, by the time we figure out that they've had a stroke, it's been past that window. So it's very difficult to give that substance.
Well, doctor, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. How many times will a stroke in a very young patient go undiagnosed?
It can be. Well, here's the thing. The testing to determine a stroke, we have two modalities. One is called a CT scan, a CAT scan. Mm-hmm. Now, CAT scan can't really pick up the signs of a stroke. Or it can, but a lot of times it misses a stroke unless it's been going on for about 6 hours. You need to have some of the secondary swelling in the brain tissue from a stroke in order to pick that up on CT scan. Now, MRI can pick up a stroke within an hour, sometimes within a half hour. However, the challenge in children is that, the MRI is a very motion-sensitive test.
Right.
So if children are moving, it's not going to give you that accurate data. I know a lot of hospitals throughout the country are getting kids into MRIs as soon as they're presenting with any signs or symptoms of a stroke within an hour, and then giving that tissue plasminogenase activator, but it's a very challenging logistical problem to solve.
Our guest today is Dr. Sohail Malik, and let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551 on this Medical Monday. And Arlene in Massachusetts. Arlene, you're on.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Ray and Dr. Malik.
Hi.
So I am the mother of a 16-year-old boy with a diagnosis of epilepsy since his age 11 months. So he had very few generalized seizures, a total of only 5 that we know of, and always easily controlled with low doses of Tegretol. But last August, our son died unexpectedly in the middle of the night, and the cause of death is presumed to have been SUDEP. Or sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, I'm sorry. So we had never heard of this term before, had never imagined that his seizures could kill him. But we're connected now with other parents who have lost children to this, usually teens or young adults. And it seems to be universally true that parents haven't been informed about it. We understand that there might be as many as 3,000 incidents of this a year in the U.S. And I wonder if you could say something about these events.
Thank you, Arlene.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Arlene. That's obviously, as child neurologists, that's our worst nightmare. And as well as, obviously, the worst nightmare of a parent to lose a child from these illnesses that are, given our modern technology and pharmacology, we feel like we can prevent it. And really, our goal is to prevent SUDEP. But you brought up a really important point, which is informing parents of the sudden unexpected death in epilepsy and the importance of taking their seizure medicines in order to prevent this. Now, the difficulty with SUDEP, and I think the reason why a lot of practitioners, and I've been guilty of this as well, the reason why a lot of practitioners shy away from it is because we don't know a lot about it. Actually, there's labs in Albany Medical Center that are studying this issue pretty heavily. Is it the actual seizure which leads to the death of the child, or is it something to do with the cells of the heart? As you know, the cells that sort of regulate the heart are fairly similar to the cells that regulate the brain. They both fire off electricity. So it could be the kids that are predisposed to SUDEP are also predisposed to having some type of cardiac issue, cardiac arrhythmias and things like that, and that may be the underlying reason. We're not really sure, and I think it's really important that the basic scientists answer that question so that we can, when we make that diagnosis of epilepsy, we can tell parents your child is at risk for SUDEP versus not. Because right now, epilepsy is a fairly common disorder, especially in childhood, and a lot of times it can be benign. I would say about 10% of Americans have one seizure during their life, And the incidence of epilepsy is about 1% to 2% in the U.S. That's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And to tell parents who've had two seizures that their child could die from these seizures is a very difficult conversation to have, and obviously increases anxiety. So I really think that once we figure out which children are predisposed to SUDEP and which children are not, this will become a lot more easy of a conversation to have, and we can target those kids. But in general, if you see your doctor and your doctor says you have a seizure disorder, you need to be on this anti-seizure medicine, take your medicine on time until your doctor says it's safe to come off.
Arlene, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it very much. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday today, and Dr. Sohail Malik is our guest. Mike in Pittsfield. Mike, you're on.
Hi, yes. Thanks for some of the information, kind of helped me out for putting to a certain extent, but I wanted to ask about, he said something about sugar and how it can affect a child's chance of stroke. And also, I got a 2.5-year-old grandson. My daughter she's been a mother for 2.5 years, so everything she's doing, she's learning. Ever since he was 6 months old, the kid has bumped his head on one or 100 different things, and it seems like it keeps on happening. He keeps bumping his head. Some are hard, nothing's been concussion type or anything like that, but he doesn't really speak he's slowly getting the understanding of speaking. He's not speaking real good. And on the other side of it is she gives him certain juices, and I know from my son's problem that he had red dye 40 made him bounce off the walls. Well, it seems to be working the same way with my grandson. Anything he has that's that type of that color or with sugar in it, he bounces off the walls, and sometimes, yeah, he bumps his head in that whole situation. What I'm wondering is, do they have correlation together? Do they help? Would one help the other one out result? Could they both, the combined situation, could it result in a bad situation for stroke or for learning disorder or anything like that? I'm really worried about the kid.
We're coming up on a break here, Mike, so let's let Dr. Malik answer.
Do you understand what I'm getting at? Do you get what I'm talking about?
So you're trying to point to, you know, maybe the sugar, maybe the red dye is causing the head injuries and also causing this speech delay with your grandson?
Well, I'm asking, does that have, do they have something in common with each other, or could the amount of bumps he's had on his head and the amount of sugar cause him to have a stroke or any problems like this in the future? I know it's really vague, but
Mike, for the most part, kids are pretty well designed to sustain these minor head injuries. We don't have any evidence that they cause any problems. As kids are learning how to walk, they're going to fall. So I wouldn't necessarily worry too much about that. Obviously, I have a lot of other questions that I'd ask in this type of situation in order to come up with a differential for your grandson as to why he's not speaking as well as he should. How old is your grandson?
He's September he'll be three. He'll be two and a half.
Okay. This is a pretty complicated problem to solve, but as long as your grandson is making progress in terms of his ability to speak clearly and, maintain conversations, I'd be pretty reassured. We don't have any direct evidence that sugar or red dye 40 leads to speech delays in the general population, but every kid is different. If your kid has an allergy to red dye, or if he's just taking excessive amounts of sugar, that could lead to problems.
We're going to take a quick break here. Our guest is Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center. The number is 800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Animals in Bronze, the Michael and Mary Erlinger collection of animalier bronzes from the Georgia Museum of Art, arkellmuseum.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entrees. Daily specials, delivery expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358. Coldham and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability, designed for the next 100 years. CNHArchitects.com. and from Gear Village, a senior community where one can age in a supportive environment at all stages of life. GearVillage.com for information. And from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the land that protects the lake, offering more than 32 miles of trails for hiking, birding, and outdoor exploration. HikeLakeGeorge.org.
Welcome back to Medical Monday. Our number is 800-348-2551. Ray Graff in for Alan Chartok today. Our guest is Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center. And back to the phones we go. All right, let's go to Marianne in Poughkeepsie. Marianne.
Hello?
You're gone. Oh, Marianne, if you call back, we'll get you back on there. You waited a long time, and you probably got very excited that... that we were picking you. Let's go to Becky in Massachusetts. Becky.
Hi.
Hi.
My question today is about my son. He has dyspraxia and speech apraxia, and I'm wondering if by changing his diet to include more DHA and omega-3s would be helpful.
Thank you for the question, Becky. You mind if I ask how old your son is?
He's 11. He was diagnosed at about age 4 or 5.
And has he made progress?
Yeah, he has. He still has delays with pulling the information from his brain to his mouth.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I'm glad that you're getting all these questions regarding diet, because I think diet's extremely important when you're thinking about sort of neurologic development. I'd say in general, the Western diet is pretty well suited towards brain development. I think the problem that we're seeing really in the U.S. isn't necessarily a lack of nutrition. It's actually too much nutrition.
Really?
Things like too much sugar, too much fat, too much of everything, too many calories, not enough activity. So, you know, I would say a lack of vitamins is unlikely to be a source, or fatty acids is unlikely to be a source of a lot of neurologic issues in kids.
Okay.
You know, I would say just give them some time. Every brain develops at their own pace, and keep pushing them.
All right, Becky, thanks a lot. Our number is 800-348-2551. Sarah in Clifton Park. Sarah, you're next.
Hi, good afternoon, and happy birthday. This isn't necessarily an inquiry directed towards child neurology, but I thought I would ask anyway because I enjoy the way you elaborate the mechanisms. I'm about 20 weeks pregnant, and I noticed neurological changes. Is baby brain syndrome or pregnancy brain a real diagnosis?
You know, there's been a lot of research into this topic, and recently I read actually a Wall Street Journal article that pointed out, you know, rather than pregnancy diminishing neurologic function, there's a lot of evidence that there's increased cognition in the maternal brain. Now, you may not notice those effects until after you actually give birth to the baby, but if you think about it, right now your entire body is geared towards supplying the womb, supplying the uterus, supplying the placenta, supplying the baby with nutrition. So all that blood flow that normally you can mobilize when you're trying to think through some very complicated cognitive problems, that extra blood flow may not be there when you're trying to do complicated things while you're pregnant. But I would anticipate that once you actually give birth, you may notice increased cognition and actually a better neurologic function.
Great.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Reason to be hopeful. Sarah, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to Marianne in Poughkeepsie. Marianne, you're on.
Hi. I took special note of your comment earlier about recovery from concussion now being recognized as taking longer than perhaps, you know, maybe even 5-10 years ago thought to have happened. So I had a concussion about 14 months ago. Really, really, really struggled to get to the point where I'm nearly at the end of it, and had typical recovery symptoms of speech and cognitive and memory and sleep disorder and photosensitivity and a whole just really a pretty classic post-concussive syndrome. The question I have is this. No one has really been able to explain to me how the brain heals from a concussion. It's a pretty simple answer. I mean, it's a probably very complex answer, but a simple question. I've done a lot of reading, and I'm trying to patch together my own understanding of what's really going on within my own brain.
Well, Marianne, thank you for your question. You know, I mean, the simple answer to your question is that we don't really know exactly how the brain recovers from a concussion. We know that in a lot of cases it does, but it's a very difficult problem to study, and it's not unique just to concussions. The human brain is a very difficult thing to study. There's a lot of moving parts, and it's very difficult, obviously, to find, you know, a comparable brain in the animal kingdom that we can study to substitute a human brain. It's a very difficult system to model. There really is nothing like it in the animal kingdom. I mean, we could study chimpanzees, but obviously there's some ethical concerns with chimpanzees. So it's a very difficult problem to study. But we do know that the brain can recover quite well. Children's brains tend to recover much, much better than adult brains because of the sort of inherent kind of plasticity of children's brains.
Sure.
But we do know that with time, with rest, and with sort of, I would say a very important part about recovering from concussion is to stay positive. Don't try to break your routines. Just try to take it a little bit easy. Don't push yourself the same way that you used to before the head injury, but don't change your routines. Don't change your lifestyle. Try to stay healthy. Try to stay active. But, you know, obviously the biggest thing with a concussion is to avoid another head injury. So keep that in mind.
All right, Marianne, thank you, and we appreciate you trying again to get through. Dr. Sohail Malik is our guest on this Medical Monday. And let's go over to line four and Woburn, Mass. And Sagata Malik, was this old home week for you, Doc?
Yep.
You're
my
on.
Mom.
Hi, Sohail. Happy birthday from all of us in Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Thanks, Mom.
Well, that's
right,
nice.
That's it.
That's
and
it.
And we're proud of you.
He's doing a very, very good job. Thank you very much.
I know. Thank
well,
you.
My parents worked very hard to get me here. So.
Wow, isn't that nice? You got a couple of birthday wishes on the program. Let's go to Pat in Gilderland. Pat, you're on. Hello? Did I hit the wrong button?
Hello?
Oh, hi, Pat. You're there.
Yes, I am. Thank you for taking my call. I have my niece who had a baby just about 9 months ago in Atlanta, and the baby suffered a stroke at birth. They were given very dire, you know, lots of things were going to go wrong with him. But they offered the stem cell blood infusions, and they've taken the baby to Duke for three of these infusions, and he is doing remarkably well. I'm wondering what you know about these studies.
Thank you for your question, Pat. I'm sorry to hear about your nephew, but I'm glad he's doing better.
Yes.
You know, I don't know much about the stem cell treatments for stroke. However, I do know that, you know, babies tend to have a lot more plasticity and, you know, maybe some inherent stem cells as well, sort of naturally.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, I've been incredibly surprised with the outcomes from some of my babies with stroke. You know, I hear this from parents all the time. My doctor said that my baby's never going to walk, never going to talk. You know, I don't make those prognoses. You know,
I don't. Because that's what they heard.
No. I think it's I think there's a few problems with that. I think sometimes it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
When you tell a parent that his kid's not going to walk, you might as well order the wheelchair now. The parents sometimes take a step back and expect the kid not to walk, and they don't push him to walk. I tell my parents who have the unfortunate situations where their kids had a stroke at a young age and lots of neurologic injury, I say ignore the imaging, ignore the MRI. I want you to focus on your child. What can your child do? Your child has to crawl before they can walk. So push your child to crawl and then focus on the next step. And I think that sort of positivity has had some good outcomes. But, you know, I do not know much about the stem cell treatment. Hopefully it becomes starts getting studied more
and
more.
I had never heard of it. Yeah. So, you know, some doctor at Duke or in Atlanta where she lives suggested it, but he is not going to be a year till July. They were told he was probably never going to walk. He's or crawl. He's crawling and pulling himself up.
That's great.
That's exciting.
That's great. Pat, thank you for the call. What is the hope that stem cells will be able to do? What are they looking for with stem cells?
I'm thinking about the stem cells might help with the regeneration of the neural tissue. With a stroke, as you know, it's because brain cells die, basically. Lack of blood flow, those brain cells die, they swell. Sometimes there's some secondary injury from that swelling. And I guess the hope would be that the stem cells can help that brain tissue regenerate. But the thing about the child's brain is that a lot of times the brain isn't the fate of that brain tissue isn't necessarily sealed yet, and other types of brain tissue can pick up the slack. I see this all the time with kids who've had stroke, and this has been proven through some complicated imaging studies. Areas that typically are used to, let's say, control the right thumb. The area that controls the area right next to it can pick up the slack when that area that controls the thumb is injured. And we know that babies are much better at doing this than adults. So babies have that sort of optimistic standpoint. So I'm not sure. I think we'd have to see a lot more clinical trials. We'd have to see stem cell treatments compared with placebo treatments in order to really tell whether there's a benefit from stem cell therapy.
Dr. Sohail Malik is our guest from Albany Medical Center. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff in for Alan Shartok. Susan in Middletown. Susan, you're on.
Hi, doctor. Thank you for coming and speaking about this. My question is, does a mother's excessively long labor that ultimately results in a cesarean that could result in twisting the baby's head out of the 90-degree alignment, you know, the orthogonal alignment to the spine, could that result in migraines over the years that ultimately result in a stroke in the visual center that I was told was a very unusual place to have a stroke?
Yes, Susan, thank you for that question. That's a fairly unusual story. You know, actually, as a pediatrician and as a pediatric neurologist, I haven't seen a lot of problems come from twisting of a newborn's head. What I'm actually would be more concerned about rather than the cervical spine or the would be the blood vessels. The blood vessels in the neck, if those get pinched off, that can certainly lead to problems, basically a stroke. But I'm not familiar necessarily with the problem, with the twisting of the head leading to long-term problems with migraines. Migraines tend to be a little bit more of a genetic disorder. Unfortunately, I'm not sure.
Susan, thanks a lot. Are migraines still a mystery to us as well?
They certainly are a mystery. We do have sort of an idea of how migraines occur. We do know that there's a very strong genetic predisposition, and it's kind of interesting. You know, males and females before puberty will actually have an equal incidence of migraines. I'm a pediatrician, and people don't think kids can get migraines. Kids can certainly get migraines. I see it all the time. Males and females fairly have an equal predominance of migraines, but once they hit puberty, males' migraines tend to go away. Female migraines tend to get worse.
So that should be a clue.
Yeah, maybe there's some type of hormonal predisposition. Estrogen may trigger some migraines. Testosterone may diminish some migraines, because sometimes these males will see as they get older and older and their testosterone levels drop, they'll start to get migraines again. However, it's not that simple. With the brain, it's never that simple. Because there's plenty of patients where I'll treat them with progesterone-based birth control, females, and, their migraines don't get any better. I would say every patient's different. Some patients will get pregnant and their migraines will go away. Some patients will get pregnant and their migraines will get worse. You have to treat every patient differently. We think migraines might be due to some type of vascular cause, the blood vessels in the skull getting large. There's actually no pain receptors in the brain itself, right? The pain receptors are around the blood vessels in the brain. So once those blood vessels get big, we think it stretches the pain receptors and triggers the migraine. In general, I'd say 99% of migraine disorders are not dangerous in terms of death of the brain tissue, but they can cause a lot of problems.
Let's go get a quick call in here before the end of the program, and we'll go to Dan in Rotterdam. Dan, you're on with Dr. Sohail Malik.
Hi. I had a motor vehicle accident in 1998 with rear window came out as a car hit the car and smashed in my head, and that caused my first brain injury. But later on, I've had a couple other car accidents, and in 2012, I was waiting to turn in a light, and I got smashed from behind from a big car. And after that accident in 2012, my memory and just general cognitive functioning has been really horrific. And I'm wondering if you might have any, I take Ritalin, which tends to help me for a little bit with my focus, but it doesn't really do that much in the long run. It does a little bit of help and then it kind of spaces me out. I'm wondering if you can advise any type of anything that might help me with organization and memory, or is this just pretty much the way it's probably going to be forever?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that, Dan. How old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 52.
So once again, I tell all my patients to stay positive. Don't think that this is going to be a long term. This is a problem that's going to affect you forever. But there are, humans tend to be very goal oriented, Dan. So I think trying to set goals to learn new skills can help you with your organization. There's a lot of evidence nowadays that for Alzheimer patients or dementia patients, that actually trying to learn a new language can help sort of stave off some of those effects of dementia. So learning new skills, learning new trades, learning new languages, those sort of goal-oriented learning can sometimes help with your organization. But I don't have, a specific answer to that question from your long-term cognition. Your injuries do sound like they're fairly significant. Motor vehicle accidents tend to be the most significant brain injuries. In fact, I don't even use the term concussion too much with these motor vehicle accidents. Usually they're traumatic brain injuries. But certainly I hope that you do get better, and I would encourage you to stay positive and have a good diet, good sleep habits.
Well, we are out of time. Dr. Malik, thanks a lot for being here. That was great.
It was a lot of fun. Ray, I want to give a shout out to my wife, who's 20 weeks pregnant.
Okay.
Love you.
Let's hope she doesn't get the migraines, you know?
Yeah, I hope so.
Well, thanks for being here, and support comes from ClipCentric Albany, a local video services division of ClipCentric, producing video advertisement for businesses throughout the capital region for web, mobile, and TV, albany.clipcentric.com. Thanks again to Dr. Sohail Malik of Albany Medical Center for being with us today. Thank you for listening, and thanks for the great calls. Thanks to the great Zach Malloy for handling the controls. Our phones were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim the Hammer Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's an open forum. Alan Shartok will be back at the helm. Meantime, stand by for news.